Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is C. Pam Zhang, author of How Much of These Hills is Gold, published April 7th by Riverhead. So Pam is kind of mysterious. So here is the only biography I have, and I hear it in each of her interviews. Born across one ocean, dragged over another, went willingly every time after. Strange stories, reluctant realist, Brown, Cambridge, Iowa, educated, lived in 13 cities and still pondering home, which I believe is San Francisco right now. But I can say that she's written for, she wrote When Your Inheritance is to Look Away for The New Yorker, Writing at a Time of Grief, which was in Lit Hub, A Year in Reading, which was in the Millions, and lots of other fiction and nonfiction as well. So How Much of These Hills is Gold is a book that has been waited for, and now here it is, the story of Lucy and Sam. Two children whose quest is one and many, I guess, and who travel on a quixotic and picaresque journey reaching for a kind of grail. They and we go backward and forward in time in an attempt to flesh out something, which at first seems kind of matter of fact in a way, but evolves into something much more than we had expected or hoped for. First, we didn't expect tigers. We didn't expect the kind of sexuality that we are presented. We did, however, expect to see a form of racism, a denial of country, a kind of denial of personhood to a certain extent. And in this case, I guess that we didn't expect a capitulation maybe on one side and a defiant rejection on the other. So in the end, we are wiser for the reading and realize as well that we've been introduced, kind of inculcated with a kind of magic, again, that we didn't expect. So welcome, Pam, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for using so many adjectives I have yet to hear used about my book.
Quixotic, yeah.
Yes.
And picaresque. Exactly. So first thing is Lauren Groff and Bill Clegg. I mean, how cool is that, right?
Yeah, very cool. It's pretty wild, I think, when you grow up a lifelong reader to then suddenly be, right, like, to be talking to people who either have written books that you've deeply admired or have helped bring those books into being.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, I interviewed Lauren for Fates and Furies, and that was a lot of fun. And I interviewed Bill for Did You Ever Have a Family? And it's really funny because I've been doing this 10 years, so hundreds of interviews. And my producer will give me books and I read them and they're really good. And then I interview somebody and then I realize, oh, this is Bill Clegg Agency. So I've done 21 books and I know of his. So I know when I interview someone that Bill Clegg is the agent for, I realize it's going to be a great book.
Do you think there are common threads? Because I actually have a hunch.
Yeah, I do think there are common threads. First of all, they're different than other books. And the covers are really cool. And he just has this... I don't know what it is. When we talked in the interview, I kind of got it, especially since he's done so much with his life and came from so many different good and bad places. And the guy's a genius. And yeah, they all have, well, yeah, we'll talk about like speculative fiction and magical realism. They all have that kind of ineffable kind of feel about them, almost all of them anyway. Mm-hmm. Why? What's your hunch?
I think my read of, so I'm like a huge fan of many of his clients. Otessa Moshfegh, Lauren Groff come to mind immediately, and also others I can't think of right now. But I think there's a quality of like voice driven prose in a lot of the fiction I think he represents. And I love a lot of it myself. It's like propulsive.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Speaking of covers, let's start with yours. First of all, how did you get Gilt and Gold? It's hard enough to get deckled edges, especially for a first novel.
Oh, is it? See, I didn't know so little about the ins and outs of this that, no, I was actually surprised because, yeah, I was really surprised because I've been looking at this cover in its digital form for months and months now. And I think my editor was so delighted with the final version of the cover, which right has this gold foil so that when you turn it in the light, like different parts of it shine. She actually sent me just a printout of just the cover before the finished hardbacks were done to show me. And it was amazing. I took it out in the sunshine and took it for a drive.
It's so funny because, I own an independent bookstore and everyone always says, you can't judge a book by its cover. And then everybody who comes into the store, without exception, judges every book in my store by its cover. So based on that, this will do incredibly, incredibly well. But yeah, the problem is now it's on the front table, it's in the window, but it doesn't do you any good because the door is locked. But we do, the curbside thing and Ingram, the distributor, now drops ships, so when someone orders it, it goes directly to them. So it's still, it's still good. But yeah,
Yeah,
and
I mean, I have to say, I know how much work the design team, there's like an illustrator who the Tigers were commissioned from. There's the graphic designer and art director on the Riverhead side. I know how hard they worked on it. It makes me sad that yeah, people won't be able to go walk into a store and just like be drawn to the amazing work that they did.
yeah, the blue is such a beautiful blue. It's like my favorite blue. And you don't see magical tigers that often. Like the last time was in The Life of Pi. And yes, it really is something. And if we're going step by step in this book, the next step would be the epigraph. And it's kind of like I'm thinking about the epigraph, this land is not your land. And Woody Guthrie and all that. And I know you've talked about it. But then I'm thinking, well, here am I. I'm this old white Jewish guy. Is it my land? Is it, is it a black woman's land? Is it a woman's land for that matter at all? Is it a Korean's man? Does anybody have the land? Whose land is this?
Right. I think it is honestly confusing. I don't know that there is a simple answer because this land has such a bloody and contested history. It's obviously been stolen many times from many people, Native Americans to begin with. But then, right, there are all these like tangled questions of I come from an immigrant family. I feel a connection to America. I am American. And right, does living here give you any right to it? It's just all the threads are so tangled. I don't know that there is an answer. So I wrote that epigraph, one, to express something that I feel, but also, I wrote it as like a bit of a, I suppose, a bit of a warning or a flag in the ground for the reader, because the other thing that happens in this book is that it is not fully realist. And I wanted people to be aware of that.
Yeah, and also it just happens that it comes at the perfect time in our history, a history which is totally imperfect at this time. And yeah, so it's much more resonant. And it's also funny too, because if we move now to the dedication, it's not often that a dedication sounds a bit like an epigraph. And in this case, what does it mean? I know it was inspired by King Lear. What does it mean to, and I know you've explained this too. What does it mean to know someone slenderly?
Yeah, so the dedication is to my father, Zhang Hongjian, who passed away a couple of years before this book was written. I've been really interested all my life in how little parents and children can know one another across the generational divide, and I think that that divide is made even greater if there was also an immigration across the generation, so that not only can you not right, understand the circumstances of your parents' childhood, but you literally are not in the place where they grew up. You can't see the same things. And that's always been fascinating to me because I feel like there is an impossibility to fully knowing my parents.
Yeah, I agree, and I feel the same way about mine. And but then again, as I thought about it, I thought, well, who do I know not slenderly?
That's true, right? Because the original Lear quote is actually about him slenderly knowing himself. And that's hard too. I do think like the characters in my book have a hard time understanding themselves as well.
Well, actually, that's kind of like the hardest thing in the world to do.
Right.
And, so that reminds me what we were chatting about virtually and briefly before, is I wanted to talk a little bit about Little House on the Prairie, because it's funny.
Yeah, what did you want to ask?
Well, because other people are writing, other people who have come from other countries are writing about the prairie, and what was it that attracted you? What was it that made you feel this feeling towards the book, about these Laura Ingalls books?
So I read them starting from when I was living in Kentucky. I lived in Kentucky for a period of my childhood. It was the first place in the United States that my family was in. And I really read her books religiously. One, it was wonderful to be able to fall into a world that continued on, because my childhood was fairly very transient. My family moved a lot. At some point, we made this like epic drive from Kentucky to move out to California. And I was like a very lonely little kid. I felt like I was constantly displaced. And in Laura Ingalls Wilder's books, there is that transience, but it's seen for its beauty and wonder, right? She traverses this landscape of America with her family, and very, even though it is realism, right, very magical things happen to them. And I really like that. I felt a sort of kinship with her.
Well, and the other thing, and especially with California and like Salinas and San Francisco, you had this, you know, I don't know, with me, it was really early on when I was like 12. And I read everything I could, everything by John Steinbeck. And I guess you kind of did too, right?
I did. Yeah. So I lived in Salinas where was he born there? But certainly there's a statue of him in front of the public library in Salinas, California. So yeah, I read a lot of him. He had a huge impact on me, I think, in terms of his rendering of the West and his sort of kind of like brutal style.
There was one, I don't know if it was in Cannery Row or... I don't know, but it was in this, he wrote about a jukebox, and when you put the nickel in the jukebox, it actually made the connection between two wires. And he said, maybe it was Grapes of Wrath, and he said that's the only time he saw money ever being useful. It actually served a purpose. And the other one was in Cannery Row, and his friends, who were all like homeless bums, they gave him like this polished crankshaft or some piece of a car in a lovely box. And it was really interesting to, which is what your book is about in part. It's really interesting. What is value? What does something that seems to be value, is it really valuable? And something that doesn't seem to be valuable at all, does it really hold all the value in the world?
Yeah, he was a great cynic.
Yeah, he was, I guess. Yes, he was. Yeah. And I wouldn't have called him that, but you're right.
Cynical about certain things, right? Like cynical about, I suppose, like the larger promise of America, about money, about status, but not cynical about humanity.
No. And then whether you take Of Mice and Men or say The Wayward Bus or something like that, you know, there's this thing he had about love, especially in Of Mice and Men, you know, mm-hmm. a different kind of love that was kind of ineffable. But anyway, should we talk about your book? We're trying to sell your book.
We can just keep talking about Steinbeck.
So if we talk about your book, and this is another theme that comes back over and over again with it and with your talks, is the idea about home. And it's not only home for the characters in your book, but it's home, the concept of home for you. And because of the way you were raised, because you can't really say it's a sticks or a bricks kind of concept of home. And same for Lucy and Sam, is, you know, the idea of what is or can anything ever become home. So how do you feel about that?
Yeah. You know, today I think I am more at peace with the idea that home may never be a fixed geographic point for me, or rather that if it is a fixed geographic point, the boundaries of that geography may be fairly narrow. Like, I don't know if I will ever feel truly at home in an entire country, right? Or maybe even a city, but home is, especially in quarantine times, like this apartment I live in with my partner and my pets. And that feels like a home, or certain rooms I'm in with friends and loved ones. Those are homes. And I think that's okay. I think that's, it's okay for me now that home is more an idea and a feeling that I carry with me rather than being tied to a geography.
Yes. I think if you can carry home with you, I think that goes a long way towards happiness. It goes a long way towards feeling comfortable in your own skin too. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that you talk about, well, one thing that I think is very brave of you, because you say you didn't write for the reader, which is unusual mm-hmm. for an author to say. It's quite an admission. But in the beginning, and so what that gives me is it gives me a lot of leeway as a reader. You know, I can do whatever I want. And so I don't have to read for the writer. It's so, well, yeah, it's like, it's not like homework. It's like, I can go wherever I want with your book. You're giving me leave to do that, which you probably would do anyway. But in the beginning, let's see, there's so many spoilers, but okay. In the beginning, I'm thinking, who cares if they bury him or not? Because he's such an asshole, you know? I just didn't care. I couldn't understand why they were thinking about doing that, especially Lucy. And then mm-hmm. things change. But do you see what I mean?
You know what's interesting is for me, because in order to write this book, which is largely kind of seen through Lucy, the older sibling's eyes, I had to really inhabit her consciousness, this traumatized child's consciousness. And so I've actually been a little bit surprised that you're not the first to say this, that some readers have been like, wow, you know, their father was like this awful man. We don't even understand why they were trying to write to honor his body and to give him a proper burial. That never even occurred to me, because I do think that when you are a child, you assume in some ways that your life is life for everyone, right? That your normal is normal. And so of course you're going to love your parent, even if they are, you know, by modern 2020 terms, abusive and alcoholic. And it was never a question.
Yeah. I mean, whatever your parents do, whether they beat you or whether they're alcoholics or gamblers, you learn as a child that that is love, because you don't know what else it would be. But that's also the reason why when you grow up, you may beat your kids or be an alcoholic or something like that, which does happen.
Yeah, but I was actually very interested in this book, in this idea of trauma and problems repeating through generations when it's left unaddressed, as it is within this family. And, you know, it's hard because, like, again, Lucy and Sam, these two children, can't fully know the circumstances of their parents' past. But I felt when I was writing this book that as an author, it was important for me structurally to be able to address the parents' past. And that's ultimately where the shape of the book came from, is through this need to, I suppose, tell different sides of the story, but in a way that had to transcend the consciousness of the two children.
Yeah. And that leads to the idea that, you know, the idea of grieving and the ritualistic idea of grieving. And so why is it so important? I mean, I understand it. And my mom died last year, and I understand the grieving process. And I also understand the honoring of it and the laughter of it, in my case, and all those things. But it seems like it's very, not only in the book, but very personally important to you too. The idea of grieving, the idea of putting things to rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really think that one of the best ways to honor anybody or anything that you're grieving for is attention. In many ways, attention and a sort of intensity of attention, those things are love, especially when you have had a very conflicted and fractious relationship with someone who is lost to you, right? And I think something that I was thinking about a lot was that it feels hard to me in American culture to talk about grief in a sort of like full way, by which I mean the way we seem to address grief as a culture is like, you know, the typical obituary, suddenly like loving father, like wonderful husband, et cetera, et cetera. And grief has this way of being simplified and sort of wiping away the complexity of a life. So suddenly you can only talk in these like positive platitudes. Suddenly, right, people who come up to you when you're grieving, the only way they can comprehend you feeling is sad. So they're like, how are you doing? You must be feeling so sad. And oftentimes you're not just sad, as I'm sure you know, you're often numb or angry or like weirdly giddy or whatever else, because the person that you're grieving was many, many complex things to you. And so in place of that simplicity, that sort of like flattened simplicity, I wanted to offer up this idea of just like attention to the full humanity of the person who is lost, whether good or bad or somewhere in between.
Yeah, that kind of makes me think about my mom's death, because my mom and I guess from the day I was born, she made me laugh. I made her laugh. And every day she would sing and I would sing with her, and she lived to be 96. And I knew the day that she stopped laughing and the day that she stopped singing would be the day she would be basically saying, which she could do. Okay, I think I'll check out now. Mm. And that's what she did. And she was in a nursing home at the time, which I'm so glad that she died when she did, because I wouldn't want her to be in a nursing home now. And if she couldn't see her three sons every day, she would have also said, like a Native American might say, I think I'll just walk into the woods and be done with all this. And yeah, so I don't know where I'm going with that, but that's just the way I feel. So actually, someone came into the bookstore, my bookstore, and they were telling me about their dad dying, and they started crying and all that. And then I started laughing. It was very inappropriate.
But it's not inappropriate.
No, it's not.
There is like nothing inappropriate about any way that you feel when grieving someone.
No, and I don't really care either. I mean, I don't mean it in a bad way, but yeah, this is the way I feel, and I'm not ashamed of the way I feel about it. And she and I had a wonderful life together, and I'd much rather celebrate it than to, yeah, I would much rather celebrate it, yes.
Absolutely.
It's interesting, because I kind of felt this way too in a lot of ways when I read your book. You talk a lot about, well, first of all, you know, you say that the first line came to you, and then maybe you put it aside or it was a short story, and then you kind of talk about channeling. But I've never really heard you describe what this channeling process was. And it's really important to me, because I've felt it myself before. So what was it like for you?
Well, the first part of the channeling process was actually just doing nothing. So after I wrote the first chapter of this book as a short story and thought I was done with it, I had these characters continue to sort of knock around in my head. You know, they would say things, I would like be whatever doing, walking down the street, and suddenly I would have this question pop into my mind of like, what would Sam doing? How would Lucy respond to this? And I really did nothing with that for as long as possible. I let these questions and these ideas build up in my head until there was just a great amount of sort of like pressure, until I had kind of like the outlines of their personalities and lives and the arc of their journeys in this book already in my head. And then the channeling was really just taking all that compressed energy and just writing. So I went to the same cafe every single day that I was working on the first draft of this book. I tried to sit in the same spot. I ordered mostly the same food, and I just did that. That was all I did.
It's interesting, because once again, it's like that ritual kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny.
Which is interesting, because it's not at all like my revision ritual. And obviously, like in terms of time, revision was the much greater part of writing this book. But my revision is a very different process, which is why, yeah, I called it channeling, the writing of the first draft. It just felt very distinct.
Yeah, it's funny when you say about revision, because it reminds me of what you said about Lauren Groff, which she also said to me, which is, you know, if you're married to the book, you know, it's done when you feel like it's time to get divorced.
Yeah, you have to hate it. You have to be so utterly sick of it.
It's funny, too, because like, I don't know why I'm obsessed with this channeling thing, but I would never go to a fortune teller, but I got drunk at a bar one time, and across the street was a fortune teller. So I said, okay. Well, I went to see her, and like I started talking about my family. She says, just shut up, you know, just be quiet. I'm doing this. And then like there was this moment, everything was kind of gone, and I just like was looking at her and she was looking at me. There was just this feeling. And then when it was done, I said, well, what the hell was that? And she goes, it was channeling. And so I've always thought of it as like this connection. And I think that, I don't know. It seems to me like, I don't know. It seems to be like you were connected to something, but it's not just like going through the same motions as you're writing. I don't mean motions that way, but it's like there's somebody telling you, or it's like the characters telling you what's going on rather than you thinking about what the characters are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I am a deep believer that when you are writing a book, probably not consciously, but everything you're sort of like thinking and feeling at that point, and probably for the past few years, is going to be in your work in some way. And, you know, I do like to talk about this channeling thing, because I feel like so often by the time we writers are sort of like put forth into the world, we have these prepared answers about like, this was my process, this was the steps I took for revision, but that's really not what writing is like. Like, you can do those things, but that's not the heart of writing. And I would love to make more room in the conversation for just like mystique and magic, because that is at the heart of writing. And I think that is why writers write. We're like trying to find that sort of like magical fountain, as I think George Saunders said somewhere in an interview.
Oh, interviewing George Saunders was like one of my favorite things. You know how everyone always says he's like a writer's writer? He was so, it was like amazing, the things he was saying. And though it was the book of, I forget which one it was. It was about death. And I said, this book really depressed me. You know, it made me feel like, you know, I'm old, I'm going to die. He goes, well, you are. He says, you're probably just going to get really sick and then you're going to die. And I said, I feel like I need therapy now. And he goes, yeah, you probably do. And it was just, the interview was just like that. But he was really fun to talk to. Not that that has anything, again, to do with your book. This is what I do in my interviews. It's weird.
I think writers actually just love talking about other writers and other books. So.
Yeah, you said that about how miserable they are. I do that in just general life. So the other thing that I've heard you mention, and I agree, is the opacity of the book. You know, the difficult. I would rather call it translucence. But this idea that it's really hard to kind of grasp, and that's what speculative fiction sometimes is. It's really hard to kind of grasp. Is this going on, or is this what I think is going on? What is really going on? And you do that a lot. And, you know, who's going to stick tigers in the middle of America, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I don't fully know how I would categorize this book as, except as not completely realist, but is that because that's the true facts of the landscape of the book, or is that because that's the filter through which children see the world? And, you know, going back to this idea of like wonder and mystique, I think that, you know, a lot of times child protagonists are a wonderful way to get back to that heart of wonder, because children see the world in ways different from adults, and I think they are more open to that magic. So, you know, it's like, are there really tigers roaming this landscape, or is it the sort of stories that these children have been told that they project onto it? I don't know that I'm interested in portraying the texture of that experience, but I don't know that I'm interested in like what the answer is.
Yeah, it's funny. I've asked a lot of authors this, you know, I say, so is your book magical realism? You know, I asked Isabel Allende about that. And half the authors, or a lot of the authors, say, no, it's not. Some of them get angry at me for using that term. And because it kind of puts them into a corner. But it's not like 100 years of solitude or something like that. But it makes me happy when I read a book that has these things in it that don't seem of this world. And I think that's a big part of the attraction of this book. For whatever reason, whether it's because, and that is, you know, that is the magic of children too. The reason mm-hmm. why children are magical is the same reason why you just discussed.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating, because I think I would be much more upset if someone read my book as straight realism than as magical realism.
Good. Well, you know, it's funny because I interviewed David Mitchell, not that I keep name dropping, but, and we were talking about Cloud Atlas, but we were talking, the book was The Bone Clocks. And he said, before he wrote the book, he said to someone, can I write a book about the real world and magical realism at the same time? And they said, no, you can't. And then he goes, but I wrote it anyway. And and it worked out fine.
Yeah.
So you know who I feel sorry for in the book? Nelly, the horse.
No, she really gets the short end of the stick.
I know, she has to carry it around, and, you know, not giving anything away, but, you know, it's just, you know, kind of like, yeah, why do I have to do all this stuff? Why am I doing all the hard labor?
Probably the one truly innocent character in the book.
True. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it that way. You know, I also thought it was cool, not that it's a big deal, but that the book starts out with this quest for silver, which has nothing to do with the quest for gold. You know, it's like the immediate quest from the very first page is this idea that they need to have silver immediately, you know?
Yeah, I actually hadn't thought about this. Yeah,
it's the idea of, okay, back to the grief thing, and this is our obligation and duty and honor. And then all of a sudden you go from one precious metal to one that's considered more precious.
Yeah, in a way, I suppose it's because in the sort of world of this book, gold is so loaded with external expectations and ideas of wealth. It's a very impersonal thing. And so in that sense, silver is a currency that is a more intimate currency, I suppose, and felt more appropriate for these personal rituals of grief.
Have you ever noticed how people, not to be like chauvinistic, but especially women, because they wear the most jewelry. Have you ever noticed that there's women who are gold women and women who are silver women?
I don't know. I would have to do a survey.
What do you think you are?
I guess I personally gravitate towards gold, but I don't have that much jewelry. So it might just be a coincidence of the few pieces I own.
It's like funny that gold is so important to so many people, and especially now the way things are. You know how they always say in the stock market, you know, people are going to gold because it's a safe haven.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny how that still is the way people think after these thousands of years, and what gold really means. I mean, there, as John Steinbeck would say, there's really no intrinsic value in it. It's just the value that we place on it.
And it's completely symbolic. It's become kind of this mythological item now, more than anything.
Yeah, I read somewhere that all the gold that has been mined in the entire history of the world would be a cube of 10 meters by 10 meters.
Really?
Yeah, kind of weird. Yeah, the other thing about gold is I never understood how, like, in the old West or during the gold West, the gold rush, that people would stake a claim, and then I always wondered how they would keep the claim, because wouldn't bad people, wouldn't thieves, wouldn't ruffians just take their claim? Did you ever think about that? I mean, you stake your claim, there it is, but then you go to town with your gold. When you come back, somebody else is there with a gun, saying, this is mine. You go, no, it's mine. I staked it. And they just say, no, it's mine.
Yeah, the history of the American West is really a history of violence, where sort of like the violence that I think has always been in the foundation of America is just much rawer and brought to the surface without any of the trappings of what we would consider like civility kind of stretched over it.
Yeah. Who was it that you said I hate cowboys? What author was it that said that?
I think that was Lauren Groff.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah, that she hates cowboys to death or something like that. And it's and then it's funny because they too have this mythological. Yeah, we've mythologized them. So there's a certain magical realism about them, whether you're watching High Noon or Magnificent Seven or something like that. There's this idea that they're good, that they're great, that they're superheroes. And in fact, it's almost exactly the opposite.
Yeah, absolutely. And so for me, it's not upsetting that people would call my book magical realism. But what is upsetting is that people might call books like Mary McMurtry's Lonesome Dove absolute realism, right? When those books are, as you said, as much mythology, as much fanciful, as much just made up.
Yeah. And then when you watch it, though, you're entranced by it and you're drawn into it. I mean, the book and the TV series or whatever it was with Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones, I think it was, you know, and you feel this, you know, you're drawn into it because you buy the myth and as most Americans, too, you also buy the violence, too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that was exactly, I think, why I ultimately wrote this book. It was a sort of like defiant stand. It was like, well, and I'm not saying I don't love Lonesome Dove. I actually adore that book, right? I adore Laura Ingalls Wilder's books, even though when you read her real life biography, it's revealed that all her life there was no way to make farming financially feasible, despite everything she does to sort of uplift it as this like great moral duty of Americans. But if they're allowed to create these like falsified ideas of America, then I'm allowed to do that too with Chinese American immigrants.
Yeah. And it really brought it home for me too, especially in this time when you have that idiot in the White House, you know, blaming the Chinese for the coronavirus and saying it was made in the lab and all, and me worrying because Sam, and Annie, we adopted from China, and Annie's from Xi'an, and her name originally was An Tata, and Samantha's was Chao Zhengji, something like that. And that reminded me in the book of how names go away too, and you're not your person because you're no longer in some ways the name that you were named.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really interesting how you lose your identity when you don't have people around you who sort of like reinforce it, who reflect it back to you.
Yeah, and it's like the other thing is, you know, Ma, and you know, when you're going backwards, Ma is an enigmatic creature who you can't decide, just as like in Ba, you can't decide at times whether what they do is honorable or dishonorable or a combination of both, especially with Ma, without giving anything away.
Mm-hmm.
How did you?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, no, I think you can't tell. And I guess I wasn't interested in making that answer clear because I think when I look at a person like Ma, who is this immigrant who came over, had this hard life, was sort of sold a false bill of promises, who is raising children in circumstances far more difficult than she was ever set up to imagine. Someone like Ma is someone who is sort of shoved into this corner in society where she has very few resources, she has very few means. And so I would never demonize Ma or judge her for the choices she has to make, because if there are any faults, I think ultimately the blame for those faults doesn't necessarily reside in Ma so much as it resides in this like system of oppression and sexism and racism that she is forced to live under.
And gold.
And gold.
So one of the things that we haven't talked about, and again, without giving anything away, is what you talk as much as you want about them, is Sam, and how this child became the child, you know, that they were, how both children, you know, Sam became Sam.
Yeah, so I don't think it's too much of a spoiler because it's sort of shown in the first like couple of pages in the book. But right, so Sam is the younger sibling of the two, and Sam is what today would be considered probably either trans or gender nonconforming. And it was really interesting to write this character into this time period because one thing I was trying not to do was sort of impose the belief systems of my personal self and of a society in 2020 upon this character where, right, there is no language for what Sam is in this world. But that was even more fascinating to me because, right, I think that labels are one thing and they can certainly be helpful and they certainly are helpful to a lot of young people today. But Sam is always and always was going to be intrinsically who they are, no matter what other people think. And so when I thought about the tropes of the cowboy Western, this sort of like swaggering, don't give a damn type of archetype, it was really interesting to me to give a lot of those qualities to Sam, who is born female, who is now trans or gender nonconforming, and is just utterly confident in himself.
Do you think Sam would have been Sam if it wasn't for Ba?
Yes, I think Sam would have been Sam without Ba. I think Sam is very canny, actually, in how they see the world, especially because, right, they've sort of like lived both sides of that gender binary. They've been perceived as a female growing up and then later presented themselves as male. So Sam is actually really, really canny about the power of gender and gender presentation. And so it's not that Ba's desires for a son turn Sam into like a trans boy. That's not it at all. It's more that Sam, who always knew who they were, understands how to make the most of Ba's desires for a son.
Yeah, and that goes to the idea of, well, first, you know, the way Sam uses a carrot or a bone to imitate a penis, you know, that kind of, well, it is a symbol. And then, you know, the way you use your chapter heads and the symbols you place for each of them, almost as bookmarkers, no pun intended, for you, how did they come about? How did they come about in your head? Especially since, you know, you kind of said at one time, I think, that you weren't sure whether they were going to stay there. They were like markers.
Right. Yeah, they were really just a sort of like craft exercise for me during the revision process. I wanted something to head each chapter so that there was kind of a North Star for the chapter that I could tighten it and feel like I was like aiming for some core motif, whether it was explicit or implicit. And that really helps me in the editing process. And then later when I look back on them, I realized that I was repeating the same chapter headers throughout all but one of the sections of the book. And this really came back to those questions that we talked about earlier of trauma repeating itself through generations. And they had this thematic resonance with what I was trying to convey in the book. So they stayed.
Yeah, I think they're really good anchors. And I think they're really good signposts for the reader. And it's interesting that you stuck with them. What did your editor, think that was a good idea?
She never said a thing about them, actually. I really loved working with my editor on this book because I think from the beginning she wasn't trying to change the core of the book. She obviously made so many comments and asked so many questions that made it better, but she was always on board with my vision for the book from the outset, and I never would have chosen an editor without making sure that we were aligned.
It's funny, too, because I was thinking about the editing process for this book, and I remember you saying I forget what station or podcast it was on, about you felt that you didn't really do dialogue that well, but you do. I was thinking about James Joyce and Ulysses in the Nighttown episode, and what he basically did was he just kind of went out to bars and listened to what people said and then just wrote it down. And that kind of became the episode. And I find that when I do that, if I'm writing something and I I remember specifically going to one bar and sitting there with a legal pad writing down what people were saying around me. And the one woman next to me was kind of intrigued, and she said, "What are you writing?" And I said, I'm writing what you say. And I kind of think that if you can get that down, that what people say is really interesting and sometimes as good as you could do, or maybe even better. Do you ever find yourself doing that, just listening?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely not. I'm actually horrified by that concept. One, I definitely eavesdrop a lot. And I think there is a lot to be taken from, observing people in the wild. At the same time, I would never, ever take down word for word what someone said. And the reason for this is, like, I think even if we're talking about realistic fiction, realism is a genre, right? It is not a perfect sort of transference of life on the page, because if you wrote a completely factual version of someone's life, there would be so many boring bits, right? Like, you'd be like, and then I woke up and then I put on my pants and then I, right, like, fed my cat. No, that's absolutely, absolutely boring. I think that for me, the role of fiction, even and especially realist fiction, is to sort of, like, take the stuff of real life, but compress it into sort of like a hyper truth that cuts closer to the emotional reality of what it feels like to live life, where certain events, certain feelings, certain minutes of the day have so much more weight than the other hundreds of minutes of the day. And so, I mean, that's fascinating to hear about Joyce's process, but I could never do that.
It's interesting because when Sam and Lucy speak, it doesn't seem to the reader, to this reader particularly, that what they're saying is so, I don't know what you're describing, some kind of shorthand for what you would normally say regularly in life. But I'm just wondering why. Well, first of all, you don't seem totally enamored of the writing process, which is also really a really interesting admission, because you kind of say that it's really, you don't say it's a horrible thing to have to do, but you do say that it's really difficult and sometimes a royal pain in the butt, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a writer in the world who would disagree with that, surely.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I agree that a lot of people feel that way, but I think, well, especially kind of like in this channeling idea, or like say with Franz Kafka or something, like writing Metamorphosis overnight. Sometimes you just can't stop. Sometimes it's just something that you, it's not like you want to write. You just have to write. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to argue with you, but I mean, and I know you were like saying, like you like to relax. I mean, you recline when you write, and you like to do that because all your energy is on the writing process, or you stop and watch Netflix or whatever. But aren't there times when you're writing that you kind of feel, I'm not saying you feel ecstatic, but aren't there times when you're writing that you feel like this is, oh, you did say it, like you're in the flow?
Yeah, of course. Those are those times. But I guess I'm trying to separate process from those moments of inspiration. I don't think that it's as clear as process necessarily, right, being the step-by-step thing you go through that will always end at a moment of inspiration. I've written entire books that I've thrown away because you can show up to the page every day. You can put down hundreds and thousands of words. You can try your very best and sort of like apply all the techniques that you know. And sometimes the magic doesn't happen and you throw it away. And so it's not, right, it's not a straightforward or a linear process at all. And most of it is very taxing and grueling. And I think you do it for those moments when you strike some chord, you find your way to that magic fountain.
I think it's very courageous for authors when they say, like you said, you have a dresser novel or more than one that you just put away. I think it's courageous because you put so much into it and then you make the decision. This is not, I don't want this out there. That must be really hard to do. Or maybe it's not. I don't know. Is it?
I think it is a little bit painful to let go of it, but once I've let go of it, I'm very relieved that I'm not putting out something that I don't stand behind in the world. So I don't feel any regret or sadness about the novels that live in the junk drawer.
Do you show them to anybody before you put them away?
Oh, no, definitely not. I only show novels that I feel fully confident of to anybody.
How do you feel about the fact that, especially given, and I don't mean to harp about it, but especially given the feeling about this being written for someone other than the reader, how do you feel about the fact that, okay, yeah, it's out there and I have it on my table waiting. How do you feel about the fact that me or anybody else is going to take this book? I mean, this is like, well, it's your first novel that's been out there. So like it's your firstborn in a way, and you've let go of it. And so how do you feel about the idea that, I perhaps imperfectly, I don't know, interpret things differently than someone else might, or that you intended? Do you give me that leeway?
Yeah, of course. I've actually been really curious to see the ways people have interacted with this novel. For example, I've heard from some readers that, you know, there is some Mandarin sprinkled in this book, and that readers who have no familiarity with the language have gone and used Google Translate. And I think that's really fascinating. And I'm go for it. I love that people are having their own relationships with this book. And I suppose it doesn't upset me for the most part, because, yeah, I think that because I was writing this book really with a desire to make it true to itself, first and foremost, I think that it is that truest form of itself is there. And the way people interact with it doesn't really nick that internal form.
Yeah, it's kind of different now, though. I mean, when I was a kid and I came across a word I didn't know or something, yes, I'd have to get up. Yeah, not like you laying on the bed. I have to get up out of my bed or out of my chair, go to the dictionary or the world book, and do all this stuff to get to the point where I understood. Now, especially if you're reading this on your iPad or Kindle, you just touch the word, the definition comes up. I mean, it's wonderful, but all that work is taken away, and you have this immediate comprehension or insight that otherwise you wouldn't have, and you didn't do the work to get there. But be that as it may. When did you learn Mandarin?
It was my first language. I was born in Beijing.
Oh, I didn't think you lived there that long.
I lived there for 4 years, but it was my first language.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, so I think what you had said was after this book, you had another novel, and again, that went into the dresser. And I think now you're once again well on your way to a second.
Perhaps. I don't know. I don't like to talk about work in progress because I'm very superstitious about it. And I think there are writers who I've talked to other writers who are as well. It just seems like too fragile a thing to sort of put before the world, even in a very like abbreviated form. So
what about your short stories, especially because some of them, as I think you said, you know, now when you write short stories, you find all of a sudden you got 7,000 words when before you had 200 or less.
Yeah, I actually haven't written a short story for maybe a year now. I'm curious to see if they will come back to me.
Well, I hope, I actually hope that they do, because they're great. And also I hope that what you're working on now, without you telling me what it is, comes out soon as well. And thanks so much for coming on and listening to me ask you these questions.
Yeah, thank you for your questions.
Okay. Hope to talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye, Sam.
Bye. So we're talking with Pam Zhang. Her book is How Much of These Hills is Gold? It's a real, what they used to call quixotic or picaresque type book, in the sense that it deals with travel, with a quest, kind of like a Holy Grail kind of book, but it's about gold and the different meanings that gold has. And it's about two children who are very, very, very different. This book is one of the most sought after books this year. I wish our store was open, but you can also order our books from Ingram, or you can order them online from us, or we can do curbside pickup as well. In any event, this book has the most beautiful cover and a great dedication and a great epigraph. But the cover is really cool. It's like gilt. It's like gold itself, and it's like gold leaf. And it has these pictures of these two blue tigers on the cover that have nothing to do with the Old West, but they're in the book. So there's an aspect of magical realism in here. And if you've been listening to me, you know how much I love that. So in any event, thanks so much for joining us today. And I look forward to having you back here next week on the Avid Reader.